Welcome, John. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. Great. Okay, here's my question. Why is Triangle Man so belligerent?
That's really up to the listener.
Okay.
It's just they're just characters sort of in their own universe. There's a lot of mystery, cooked into these songs.
Yeah. Well, I've written so many interpretations of it, and people try to think too much, too deeply about it. But I know it's not intentionally written for kids, but somehow it started your foray into children's music. Which character, Particle Man, Triangle Man, Universe Man, or Person Man, do kids like the most?
We haven't really surveyed the kids. I think a lot of people are drawn to the cartoon violence of the song, though. It's a good place to get out your hostilities.
Okay. Well, we'll get to the kids' music later. I know that They Might Be Giants was formed in 82. That's 41 years ago. And I had to do the math because, that's my era too, in the 80s, the music era. I know you two met and hung out in high school.
Yeah, John and I both worked on the school paper together.
Oh, the school paper. Okay. Now, were you writing songs then?
Not really. John was in a band with friends of ours, and they were doing but they were like a high school cover band, and I was doing these sort of they're almost impossible to describe. I was just really, I had a tape recorder, and I would do these kind of feedback exploration sound pieces that would be probably just like sort of a 15-year-old's interpretation of like a Brian Eno ambient music record, probably. So we were interested in sound, and we were interested in music, but we didn't really get to songwriting. I mean, it's you know we are so long in the tooth that we actually were affected by historic events of the mid rock era. I mean, basically when punk rock came into vogue, we were the perfect age to be hypnotized by all that, like sort of the get moving away from math rock and art rock and California jam rock, and just kind of turning back into writing song short songs and melodic songs, and really thinking about songs as the vehicle of the musical expression. So that was, we were really affected by those, big turns in music. I mean, more than disco, I guess.
Right. That's interesting. Were you guys science nerds, or am I wrong?
No, we were rock nerds. We were just we were really into rock music. It was really a lot of our cultural life. I mean, we went. I had a fake ID. I would go to rock clubs in Boston. With my friend Jimmy and with John, and we would see shows at the Rat and other concerts. We saw a lot of concerts together. That was really, something that was really a big part of our lives. We actually saw, me and my friend Jimmy saw the Cars' second show ever, their second public show. Jimmy saw their first public show, which is at like a high school, I think in like Framingham or something. And then I saw them at the Rat like a week later with him. And, it was really interesting seeing a band that would go on to be so huge in such an embryonic state. They were very well rehearsed. It was like an object lesson in how to make a good impression. They were in an era where a lot of bands were could barely make it to the stage. They were more than prepared.
I've heard about the legendary shows at the Rat. I went to school at Brandeis, and so I used to hang out. But at that point, I kind of know how old you are. I'm not going to ask, but the legal age went from 18 to 21 while I was in college, and I couldn't get in there. I got in there, and then I couldn't get in there anymore.
where the fake ID really came in.
Oh, handy. Right. So you had the same problem.
I was getting into the rap when I was like 16 years old. So. It was fun.
Yeah, I've heard about the Cars playing there. And so you're saying that they were really well rehearsed. I guess that's a good lesson, you know, going into the music business, knowing, hey, you know, we really need to get our act together before we play out.
I think it's amazing how simple it can be. I think it's really important to put on a good show, and a lot of bands seem to not really take it that seriously. I'm not, you know, good luck to all bands, but it's definitely a pretty simple gimmick.
Now, I'd like to talk to you about your recent project, Book. It was released in...
Our Grammy-losing effort.
Oh, really?
Ah. Well, you know, it's an honor just to win. We've won two Grammys and we've been nominated for two others, and I guess once you win one, you just sort of feel like you want to keep on winning them. It's a really cool project just in and of itself, and we did it for the greater glory of John and I collaborated with Paul Sayre, who's our long-term designer. He's done a lot of album covers for us, and he's done some videos for us. And we talked about doing, you know, various book projects, and we've been approached by book publishers about various book projects. And I guess the truth is, like, we're more interested in making new stuff than, like, memorializing our old stuff. We sort of embarked on putting the book project together as a way to check that idea out, see what we could do that was all new. So we worked with a art photographer, this fellow Brian Carlson from Brooklyn, who does street photography, and his stuff is very dramatic and very unusual, and it seemed like they complemented the lyrics of the songs really well, and so we just put this whole book together for this album release, and it's all the lyrics were actually typed up on a 1973 IBM Selectric typewriter, not too different than I think what Jack Nicholson was using in The Shining, and it's just an interesting object, you know, it's interesting to make something that's to work on a project that's as much about kind of aesthetic beauty as it is about impact, you know, in making, doing writing songs and making recordings, a lot of times, like, you're really just trying to, like, be as bold as possible. With the book, it was more about, like, the flow of it and kind of just, just having something that was visually engaging.
Now, you have an art degree, so that's part of, you're not just a songwriter, is that right? So that
I went to the Pratt Institute, and that was actually when, like, things really started with the band. John was living in the same building as me, and, so we started, that was where things really started cooking with They Might Be Giants. But I've always had that kind of design interest in my back pocket, and it's helped a lot in terms of just kind of keeping the ball rolling visually. I think I was just looking, we're doing all these vinyl record reissues, and someone at our office made a GIF of all the album covers just kind of cycling through one another in a GIF, and I have to say, like, it made me kind of proud that how interesting, like, the artwork is attached to our work. Like, I feel like it's a lot of it's pretty original and pretty engaging, and it's not all the same. So it's like it was nice to see it all kind of flying by in that weird GIF way.
Right. So, you know, just
GIF.
Yeah. Who knows? Well, I don't know if you saw this quote or even if I got it off your website, but a publication called Pop Matters, quote, after 40 years and 20 plus albums that span many, many genres, but are almost always filled with big hooks and endearing bizarreness, They Might Be Giants are as energetic and interesting as ever. The fact that they've always had an absurdist bent and an experimental side essentially lets them do whatever they want. Book is a thoroughly enjoyable record from start to finish. So.
Oh, that's an excellent review.
I know.
I think it's a very strong album. I mean, I think we've worked, you know, pretty diligently to, you know, to keep the quality high. You know, it helps that both John and I are songwriters, and it helps that in some ways we're sort of, you know, in competition with one another as well as collaborating with one another. It's good to kind of have to come up to a standard rather than a lot of, you know, I was listening to an interview with like a very successful rock star the other day, and he had this very sort of just like, I do what I want kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is like, I guess, kind of standard issue stuff in the world of rock music. You know, people, a lot of sort of arrogant behavior is really sort of sanctioned and promoted. And like having that kind of swagger is something that it seemed like the person interviewing him was almost goading him on, like he was really celebrating it. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the truth is, it's like a lot of time you can do a lot of really good work just because you are working within a critical context. Like, you know, I don't want to work on songs I'm not proud of with John. Like, it's just too, it would be too much pressure, like, looking to him to, like, you know, save me from myself. And so it's just very different being in a collaboration and being in a band, you know, than being kind of an autocratic band leader and just saying, like, this is what I did, like, that's good enough, let's go, you know, give me your best shot at this. So I feel like, you know, we really have kind of kept each other on our toes and hopefully, you know, really helped, been consistent.
It's a formula that seems to be working after so many years. Are you going to be playing any songs from the new album?
Say what?
Are you going to be playing any songs from the new album at the Pleasantville Music Festival?
Not to give too much away, but we often start the show with the song Synopsis for Latecomers, which is the first song off the album, and it's a really good show opener. It's one of those songs that, like, not every song, you know, anybody does kind of works like in real time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't have to have heard it before to be kind of intrigued by it, which is like a really nice quality in a song. And so it's a great show opener, just because of the nature of the lyric and the sort of the linear quality of the song. And it ends really big as well. So it's like, it's just a great, it's a consistently an exciting way to open the show. And it's nice to open the show with something new. So,
right.
But yeah, we do a bunch of songs off the album, and they go over very well. I mean, in part because the ones that we do, I think, have had videos to them and have gotten more exposure on, like, alternative radio. We don't go, like, deep into the album tracks. It would be nice to, because I think it's like, we have a few albums that, you know, of recent vintage that have, you know, a pretty solid song selection. So, mm-hmm. You know, someday soon.
You know,
we're headlining a festival. We're going to be on stage for an hour, so there's only, you know, we've got to cram in a lot of those 40 years.
I know. That's, well, you know, from the interview, one of the interviews I saw, you're the one who puts the song list together, no? Am I wrong?
Yeah. I've been doing that pretty much since day one. I don't know how it fell to me. I mean, I have early set lists that John and I clearly worked on together because it's in both of our handwriting, so it was something that got discussed. But at a certain point, I guess I was just like more preoccupied with the theater of the show, like just trying to pace it, so things kept on changing, and it just ended up, the task kind of fell to me. But you know, I take it seriously. You know, I mean, I make sure that, you know, everybody looks good.
Yeah. your 1990 album Flood was your, I guess, your best-selling album. It's considered, it's an iconic album, an audience favorite. But you released 15 albums after that. And so, like, how do you find the balance between, like, playing a multitude, like you just said, you have one hour. Like, how do you do that? How do you give the audience, like, their favorites, but also, like, show them that there's some great new stuff out there that they haven't discovered or they'll love? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, there is, like, this sort of the, I think it's very possible that there are people within our audience who would like us to, you know, simply just play songs from Flood, and that would be fine with them, and anything else is just kind of in the way. But the truth is, you know, there's a real percentage of our audience that, you know, has been with the band for a long time and has tracked everything we've done, and there's a whole set of songs from before Flood and after Flood that they're just as interested in checking out, and songs that are, they're, you know, fan favorites from, you know, almost every you know, year of the band. So there's lots of, I mean, one nice thing about being in a band this long is it's not hard putting a show together, because there's a ton of songs that people clearly love, and some of them are, you know, really out of left field. I mean, we do a song called Older that was the album version of it was on a record called Mink Car that was only in print for a very brief period, because it came out on 9/11, and the record company that put it out basically went out of business about a month after that. Mm-hmm. So, like, there was a long interval of time where the album wasn't even streaming, and it was like the ability to print the record was, like, sort of held up in a rights knot because the company had gone out of business. And, like, there's a song, speaking of songs that kind of make sense just when you hear them, the song Older, you know, has this, it functions in a totally linear way. Like, you hear the song and you get it. Like, it's like, you know, the first time you hear it, you will, you know, people kind of chuckle, because it just works that way. And that's like one of our, you know, that's like a huge part. People love that song in our live show. And it's not really attached to any big hit album. It's probably our most obscure album in a way. So, but it's just a show-stopping song that people really get a kick out of. And so it's kind of a standalone thing. And there's a lot of examples of things like that. You know, we just songs that are just have become audience favorites kind of on their own for various different reasons, you know, just like whatever's happening in the arrangement of the song. Sometimes it's like they're, you know, they're beloved because they're kind of jumping off points for improv and you know, different hot takes, but you know, there's a lot of good stuff.
I was listening to an interview, I don't know if you remember, 2018 with through Google Arts and Culture. And it was right after your 20th studio album, I Like Fun, came out. And you talked about the early challenges breaking into the music world and getting gigs in the New York City clubs in the mid-80s. And the literal boundaries. You mentioned there were no reviews below 14th Street. And you found an audience in the cultural bubble in the East Village that, like, you described as like a transgressive scene. Performance arts.
You know, I mean, it was basically a very New York kind of demi-monde vibe. You know, it was very late night, and it was very druggy, and it was very sexual, and you know, it was basically, you know, Ron DeSantis' worst nightmare. but you know, that's what it was. I mean, New York was it felt like Berlin in the mid-30s, you know. It was definitely a kind of a wild place. And it was, but, you know, it was also like a very artistic scene. Like, there was a lot of creativity and a lot of energy and a lot of young people doing stuff in a very exploratory way. And, And it was a scene unto itself. Like, it wasn't an audition for something else. Like, a lot of times, especially if you're in like a smaller town, you know, everything is sort of focused on trying to get to the next place and get something going that's going to take you out of that town. Being in New York and playing in a downtown scene that had its own audience and its own kind of culture, it was a lot of weirdos united together in a very powerful way, and it was a hell of a lot of fun and really interesting to just be a participant in. You know, I mean, I definitely felt way more kind of normal, normcore kind of. I mean, I definitely was not. We were always the kind of the most understandable thing on the bill for the most part. You know, like, we were kind of the closest to like something that people would call a rock band or you know, whatever. But it was a great time.
Because you described them as like performance arts clubs that really championed originality. And
well, that was the best part about it, was that, you know, I'm coming from being in bands in Ohio where there were club owners who would expect you to play cover songs and just sort of fit into the idea of what a local band should be. Coming to New York, all the club owners that we dealt with at 8BC and the Pyramid Club and Dorinka, they just wanted original acts. They just, you know, they didn't even care if you were a band. They just wanted something that nobody had ever seen before. And it was very sensationalistic in a way, but it seemed like the main thing was just do something original. And that was very encouraging.
Did you ever play, it's not even on my question list, but did you ever play covers? I can't imagine that would be something you do. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, a little later on when we started touring, we actually did a show where we were contractually obliged to play 2 hours of non-repeating music in a place that probably mostly had cover bands in Norfolk, Virginia. And that was where we learned the covers that we, two of the most successful covers that we do, the song Istanbul is actually a cover from the 50s. And we put it in the show basically just to extend our repertoire because we didn't have enough songs. So, I mean, you know, our original intention was just to do original songs, but we added that one just because we needed more tunes.
So like a big hit came out of, you know, out of being over. Forced to
it
do
was.
A cover. So a big hit of yours came out of having been forced to fill out the time with music. With
exactly.
That's I did not know that. I'm glad I asked.
It was pretty unexpected, but you know, it went over really well, and again, it had sort of an immediate impact. Like, it's a very melodic song, and it just hits people very quickly.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you. Let's see, I understand that Particle Man was written way before you started writing children's music. You later wrote albums that, like, bestsellers for kids. Here Comes the ABCs, Here Comes the 1-2-3s. I've heard you and John say that writing for kids is an open invitation to write about anything, and whereby critics can't say anything bad. I suppose...
They can say lots of bad.
Yeah, well, certainly. I suppose there's a freedom in writing kids' music. Now, was writing children's music just by chance, or was that intentional?
Well, you know, the story sounds much more cynical than it really was, but, like, John and I got off of Elektra after about 10 years and were immediately inundated with a lot of different offers. I mean, that was when we started writing music for television and doing theme songs, and we did the Austin Powers movie song, and I'm trying to think. We just, all of a sudden, like, we were available to the outside world, and one of the one of the invitations we got was from the people at Rounder Records who were doing kids stuff at that point, and they just said, like, you know, if you're interested in doing a one-off kids album, we'd love to put it out. And it seemed like a way to just sort of do something off the record. It seemed like it was before we did our first kids project, it seemed like it would probably be received like a Christmas record. You know, just like it's like a sort of a happy one-off that would be, you know, celebrated for a long time afterwards. It's like, you know, those guys did a kids record. It's really interesting. And so we poured a lot of our, you know, imagination into making this first kids record, which is called No. And it's a really good record. I'm very proud of that one specifically. I think it's got a really interesting aspect to it, which is it's not at all educational. I mean, almost, you know, everything else we've done for kids has had kind of a slight educational veneer. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about No is it's just for fun. And it was really an interesting project. I mean, at the time we were doing all this incidental music for The Daily Show and for Malcolm in the Middle, and that was very much like our job. Mm-hmm. And at the end of any given recording session, we would record, you know, a song or two for the No album. And so it was like everything about it was kind of done, like it was just like doing your personal work at the end of the workday at your job, you know. So it's like sneaking in your personal passion project. And it felt like that. And I feel like the results of the album kind of are evidence of that. Like it was something we just did for the challenge of it. And it was, you know, it came out really good. And but then the unintended consequence was that all of a sudden we had this almost, you know, a parallel career that was, you know, extremely successful. I mean, we were not anticipating the reception it would get. It was, you know, there were a lot of parents who were very interested in the project, and you know, it seemed to be very, like, you know, thirsty for They Might Be Giants children's stuff.
Right. You know, I'm thinking about the interview. I saw the Google interview, and I how you and John are always looking for, like, new ideas, new nouns, new concepts. So I suppose I love that. I love that when you talked about using and then having to use the same nouns again. I love that story. But I'm wondering.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, when you have a song, when your biggest song is about a bird, you sort of start feeling, you're having second thoughts, like just starting to write another song about a bird, you know? It's like,
right.
At a certain point, you just wonder if you're like, if you're actually running out of.
Of ideas.
You know, physical objects in the world.
But I would suspect that writing for kids and at the same time parents, because, you know, we're all, as parents, listening to the songs too, that you've, like, extended the life and broadened your audience because of it as well.
Well, it does seem, again, like, you know, I don't want to come across as, like, you know, some super calculating, you know, marketing person.
Right.
But it certainly does. It doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, you know, we have tons of people coming out to our shows who've literally, you know, been listening to our music since they were five, and now they're just, you know, full blown adults. I mean, it's a does anything sound more jive than saying, like, you know, it's for every, you know, the band is for the whole family? But it kind of is, you know. It's strange. Like, there are tons of people at our shows who have, you know, have just always been listening to They Might Be Giants in one way or another, which is very, very odd.
Now, change of subject. Your seventh studio album was released in 1999, Long Tall Weekend. It was released exclusively digitally. And I guess you were ahead of
the very beginning of internet music, like downloading MP3s and, you know, iTunes and all that stuff.
Now, you obviously were early in embracing the digital format. What's your thoughts about, well, I wouldn't even say recent, but in the last, 10 years, how vinyl returned, and now people are buying cassettes again. Like, what's your thoughts on people?
Well, I don't know how much people are actually buying cassettes. I think it seems like a very unlikely turn.
Right.
I think that I feel like people are buying cassettes the way that people are butchering their own meat. Like, I think there definitely are more people doing it than before, but I'm not sure that it's actually like a meaningful number of people.
But vinyl for sure.
The vinyl thing is fascinating to me because it's really turned into a cottage industry for us. Starting about 5 years ago, we just started seeing like a really steady spike in the amount of vinyl that we were selling, and every title we would put out would get like met with a tremendous amount of interest. And so we really issued for the first time things on vinyl from our catalog over the years, probably a half dozen titles or more in the past couple of years, and which takes a lot of work, just reassembling the artwork and finding the assets and sometimes getting things remastered and pulling it together is a little bit of a hustle, but there's a lot of interest in vinyl right now. And it's, as a music fan, as a music lover, it is kind of heartening. I feel like those people, they want to have the music experience, like they want to listen to songs and not be distracted and not just have it be like a peripheral thing. Let's kind of immerse themselves in these albums, and listening on vinyl is a way that happens. And so that's exciting to me. I mean, vinyl is in my life, so I completely understand where those people are coming from. But we've lived through all these formats. I mean, when we first got our indie record deal, it was through Bar None Records, and one of the owners of the label ran the record shop in Hoboken, and he had no interest in making CDs. And we were like, but what if we want, this was like the year CDs were coming into, the primary mode of recorded music. And we were like, well, we would like our record to be on a CD, like not just vinyl. And he was like, well, if you want to put it on CD, you're free to do it. And I was like, okay. And then we, relicensed it to another company to have it be on CD initially. And, he was that sure that CDs would not catch on. And but formats come and go. Like, it's one of the things about, as you get older, you just see things, things change. Then, and then things change back.
You span of your career, the band's life, you've seen that probably more than most bands.
I work in a record store that sold 8 tracks. Like short of wax cylinders, I feel like I've kind of seen it all.
And I asked Bruce Figler, who's the festival's director, what to say to you and share. He said, quote, they should expect fun, an enthusiastic crowd. They should expect people singing with them, and it will be a chill, fun evening in the shadows of their hometown. He also said over the years, because he lives in Pleasantville, over the years, many Brooklynites moved up to Pleasantville and all of Westchester. So you might be running across some old friends.
Oh, yeah. No, our drummer we worked with years ago, is in the town, is coming out. We actually just were talking with him on email. And, it's great that it's also, Metro North comes right through there. It's a very easy commute for New Yorkers if you want to just pop up and see the show.
He also mentioned that I asked him if you're going to be playing as a duo or a band. He says you're actually bringing some horns. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. It's an eight-piece band. Mark Pender, the trumpet player from the Conan O'Brien show, is joining us. And he's just like, he's a whole show unto himself. We're it's a big night of music.
Can you share with me the names of the musicians that are going to be playing at the Pleasantville Music Festival?
Sure. It's Marty Beller is playing the drums, B-E-L-L-E-R. Van Miller is playing guitar. Danny Weinkoff is playing bass. I believe it's W-E-I-N-K-A-U-F. And the horn players are Dan Levine on the trombone, L-E-V-I-N-E, and Mark Loveman Pender on the trumpet. Loveman is in quotes. Pender's P-E-N-D-E-R. And Stan Harrison, a very talented saxophonist, is joining us as well.
I have just a couple of more questions. These are kind of, I'm not sure if I'm going to include this in the interview or not, but I'm excited about it. I understand that this is the end of your tour, and then you're going to be going to Hollywood Bowl opening for Sparks.
Yeah, 4,000 capacity venue, and it's Hollywood Bowl is. I have in-laws now from Hollywood, and the Hollywood Bowl is a very beloved venue. You say the Hollywood Bowl, and people just like smile and kind of sigh and look off into the horizon. It's like everybody loves the Hollywood Bowl. It's I can't imagine it's really. I would imagine it's a little bit like playing Radio City Music Hall in the daylight, which doesn't seem
right.
that much fun to me. But people just, everybody comes out for these shows. It's like, it's a total party.
It's going to be, it's such a perfect bill. I mean, it's going to be fun. I feel like flying out there just to see the...
Oh, yeah. I know people who are flying out to see it. It's wild. People are very, very into the bill. And, we grew up with Sparks. So, we're excited to be sharing the stage with them.
And then you're heading off to Australia. I see that you've been selling out shows and you had to like open up more dates. Is that true?
Both the English tour and the Australian tour have been extended almost both of them have essentially been like doubled. Like we booked like a half dozen shows in both places and then they sold out very quickly and now we're adding sort of half again as many or as many shows in both places. So
wow.
It's exciting to sell out shows, I gotta say. I mean we just sold out like 80 shows across the US, so it's like which has like never happened before to us, so it's just a blast.
Obviously been able to maintain your popularity, the love, your audience loves you, they're loyal. They have new audiences.
They're very loyal. I think performing Flood was a huge kind of it really moved the needle. I think a lot of people who don't even go to shows anymore, when they heard that we were doing that, like they just decided to get out of the house. That clearly is part of it. It's like there's a certain we have an active audience, and then we have people who are There's this funny thing about seeing shows, right? If you see a band live, you've seen them. And you can always say, like, yeah, I've seen those guys. Like, so it's like, in a weird way, we might have done a show in 1989 that somebody saw, and they're like, yeah, I know what They Might Be Giants is like as a band. But they haven't seen us in, like, 30 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's true that you've seen They Might Be Giants, but if you haven't seen us in this century, maybe you want to
I saw you guys perform, I don't know how many years ago. It was at Daryl's house in Pauling.
Oh my God, yeah. Oh, those are such hilarious shows. What a little subway car of a venue.
The impetus was my 20-something-year-old kid who also went to Pratt, by the way. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, they wanted to go. And I'm like, oh gosh, I've never seen They Might Be Giants. And what a blast. I mean, that was...
Oh, that's so great. See, now that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Like, this makes it look like it's all a master plan, but it's really just, we're just putting out our shingle, and hoping for the best.
And there were a lot of young people. I mean, yeah, you're definitely garnering a more like younger audience. You've got longevity, you've got new fans. I see it. I saw it
Yeah,
firsthand, and it
great.
was man, it was fun.
Well, I'm so glad you came. See, that's our dream.
And lastly, wasn't sure if I should ask this, but are you bringing your custom iconic Chessmaker guitar to the to Pleasantville?
I am not. It resides in my living room in my apartment in New York City. And I do play it on a regular basis, but my guitar tech finds that it is not stable enough in the tuning department. It's a beautiful object. It is just not it's just not quite as reliable an instrument. I say it's better than it has to be, but he disagrees. We're working on it. It always makes a big splash whenever I play it because it's a crazy looking instrument, but you know, it also has to work.
But when it's in tune, are you happy with it? Besides it being beautifully.
You know, it's got pickups from the original Gretsch factory, you know, that are very coveted these days, like pickups that were made in like 1959, probably. So it's, you know, it's got a very vibey sound, but you know, but it's as much for visual impact as anything else.
I see.
For people who are unfamiliar with it, it basically looks like a chess piece. So.
Yeah, I'm going to probably use a photo in the blog so people can see what it
Oh
looks
yeah,
like.
perfect. That's fantastic.
I can't wait to see you guys play with the 8-piece band at Pleasantville Music Festival. It is seriously going to be a lot of fun.
Well, thank you
It's
so
a
much for your
great
support,
honor to.
and thanks for the interesting questions. This was fun.
Well, thank you so much. Have a good one.
All right, great. You too.
Thank
Bye-bye.
you. Bye-bye.